call this meeting to order. Commissioner Studley?
Here.
Commissioner Han?
Here.
Commissioner Ward?
Here.
Commissioner Liu?
Here.
Before we begin, I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome Commissioner Liu to the commission. We look forward to serving with you.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
The first item on the agenda is a proposed amendment to... Public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda and within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission.
Good evening, Commissioners. Thomas Piccirillo. I assume that this is the opportunity to make public comment on the next item on the agenda, because there's an opportunity for public comment on that item. Is that correct?
There will be an opportunity for public comment on the next agenda item.
Oh, okay. Then I'll pass for the moment.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Any other public comment on matters appearing on the agenda or within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission? So the next item on the agenda is consideration of amendment to Governmental Conduct Code Section 3.234. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this matter?
Okay. The Board of Supervisors has adopted this measure and referred it to the Ethics Commission. That will allow someone who was appointed to the office of mayor to serve a partial term, who is not then running for the office, to return to city employment if they were a city employee prior to being named as interim mayor. Obviously, we know this is designed so that Mayor Ed Lee can go back to being city administrator at the end of his term when a new mayor is elected in November. When the staff received this measure, we realized that the law that it was amending applies to both the mayor and the members of the Board of Supervisors. So staff determined that we would add for your consideration members of the board as well. Since the law applies to both members of the board and the mayor, the staff made an alteration to the board proposal. It will be a policy decision for the commissioners to decide whether to follow that recommendation by the staff. Additionally, there has been some concern about exactly which position or positions the former city employee interim mayor and then former mayor would take place. So we have language that would narrow the scope further so that the person appointed mayor could only go back to the same job that they held prior to being appointed the office of mayor. So before you essentially have the board's proposal, which is just to the mayor, the staff amended proposal, which is mayor and board, and then the third one, which is also mayor and board, the way it's written, but would narrow the scope of the waiver. So there's a couple decisions here, how narrow you want to make it and whether to include the board or not.
Okay. I understand that a representative from Supervisor Chu office.
He just walked in.
There he is, Mr. Chu.
First, let me compliment you on your efficiency. My name is Judson Chu. I'm an aide to Board of Supervisors President David Chu. And thank you very much for considering this legislation. Can I just ask, did you go through the overview of it from a staff perspective? Okay, so I don't want to retrod any well-trodden ground. And also congratulations to the new commissioner, and thank you, Chair Herr. We believe this is very straightforward legislation. I think it's received quite a bit of media attention, and the explanation is clear. We see it as narrowly crafted legislation to address a particular circumstance, and that is our intention with it. The purpose of this restriction on mayors and, of course, members of the board as well, since that's coming up in your discussion, is to not allow such an individual to leverage an elected office into a golden parachute or really into a position with the city that would not be a fair thing for them to do. So that's really what it's about. The legislation is expected to be at the board if you all approve it soon, and we hope that it will meet with your approval. I know that there is a suggested amendment. Did you already go over that yet?
Yes.
And honestly, the position of President Chu, and I believe I talked to a couple of his colleagues briefly, is that it's, you know, we're willing to work with whatever the commission sees fit. I think that it seems like there's a policy argument to make it consistent, but we see that as it's a pretty unlikely scenario. Clearly, we've only dealt with this particular situation of an appointed mayor for the first time really in a generation, and we don't expect to deal with it or very often. Supervisors obviously are appointed more frequently, but tend to almost exclusively run for election. But if there was a circumstance where an appointed supervisor did not and did come from the city ranks, it does seem to make sense that said supervisor could return to the city ranks. So I'm happy to take any questions or to expound more on any of the particular issues. But again, it's nice to be here, and thank you very much for your consideration.
Commissioners, any questions for Mr. Tru?
I have one. Mr. Tru, do you see any policy considerations against the further amendment to narrowly tailor it so the exception just applies to the same position, going back to the same position? That actually was a question I had. I was going to ask.
I think, yes, I so that was discussed as well. I apologize for not being here right at the beginning of the meeting. I had heard that was under discussion. Again, I think we would look to the commission. We are most interested in as simple and as straightforward a piece of legislation as possible. I think that might complicate it a little bit, but not in a way that President Chu or I believe most of his colleagues would find problematic. This is addressed. It is designed to address a narrowly tailored situation. And one thing we learned in the entire intermayor discussion is that there are always going to be some twists and turns that legislation can't address. So I think that while it may make sense to have a little more flexibility, I think if there's a future situation, it's possible that more legislation could be required. And that's just the way the cookie crumbles. So so my baseline answer on that is that President Chu would support whatever the Ethics Commission sees fit on the position that the individual could return to. I think that one other conversation that we had briefly this afternoon was about the idea of restricting the salary of the position of whatever role the individual had rather than the actual position. It's possible, for example, and this was a hypothetical that I thought of today, that if now Supervisor Carmen Chu had been appointed to serve as a supervisor, had decided not to pull papers and run for your election, and then was going to back to be deputy director of the mayor's budget office, potentially if the director position was open, and that made the most sense for the mayor and the city to have her in that position, it would seem like a little bit of it wouldn't be clear what policy goal would be accomplished in not having her fill that role. Now, again, that being said, that's a pretty narrow, unusual circumstance. You can pretty much come up with hypotheticals. You know, for any, it's going to be hard to cover all hypotheticals in legislation. So, again, I'd throw out that idea of having the salary be the key instead of the position. But I would leave it in the hands of the commission. In general, and on California Political Reform Act, the key is that elected officials can't do anything that would cause additional remuneration for themselves that would financially benefit them in some way. So that would be the rationale for that idea, but it's sort of a recent idea, so I would really leave it in the hands of the commission to consider it.
Thank you, Mr. Tru.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Other questions for Mr. Tru? Commissioner Studley?
Oh. Can you tell us what the timing or process would be if the commission did not approve a provision now? If a change needed to go, if you failed to get the 4/5 majority and it needed to go on a ballot, what ballot would that be?
Thank you through the chair,
Mr. St. Croix, as well.
Commissioner Studley. My understanding, and this is a little bit preliminary, I might defer to the city attorney, is that there has been a ballot measure very similar, exactly similar to the duplicate of the legislation that's before you, and that is has been submitted to the Department of Elections by four or more supervisors and would go on the next ballot. I do believe it's possible that it could be withdrawn since there is no June election. There's still talk of a September election or and obviously there's a November election, but I would defer to the city attorney for a definitive answer.
Yeah, as Mr. True said, the five supervisors submitted the measure appearance on the June ballot. There won't be a June election. Actually, that measure is then withdrawn automatically. The supervisors can resubmit it for the November ballot or if there is an earlier election. But as of now, it's not officially going to appear on a ballot.
So much for the argument in favor that we had to write. No.
Any other questions by the commission for Mr. True?
Thank you very much.
I think it makes sense for us to consider the proposals perhaps in order, and I think it might make the most sense to begin with the amendment proposed by the staff just at the beginning of this agenda item. Mr. St. Croix, can you actually read the language that you're now proposing?
The more restrictive?
Yes, the more restrictive language.
Okay. Okay. The language reads, notwithstanding the one-year restriction in subsection A, a former mayor or member of the Board of Supervisors who was appointed to that office under Charter Section 13.101.5 to fill a vacancy and who did not subsequently file a declaration of candidacy for election to that office shall be eligible for reappointment to the city position or office he or she held immediately prior to assuming office as mayor or member of the Board of Supervisors. So the key language that's inserted is, for reappointment to the city position or office he or she held immediately prior to assuming office as mayor or member of the Board of Supervisors.
Commissioners, any comments on that particular proposal?
Commissioner Sutton? You can take Mr. Ward first.
It's actually a question. In the position that the current mayor is in, if he were to return to his former position, isn't that a mayoral appointment or hire? What if the mayor decides that he doesn't want to hire him for that position? But someone else in city government is willing to hire him into a different position.
Under this language, would not be able to take the different position.
While I'm at it, I'd just like to add that I would not be in favor of extending this to this instance. I think it's pretty clear that what we're attempting to do is uphold kind of a promise that was made to the mayor that if he accepted this appointment that he would be able to return to his former job, and that was his reluctance in accepting the position. I think the public would be awfully surprised to learn that in the process of our trying to honor a promise made to the mayor that he would be eligible to get his job back, that all of a sudden now we've extended it to the Board of Supervisors. The threshold for being appointed mayor is that you have to be voted on by the entire Board of Supervisors. In order to be appointed a member of the Board of Supervisors, you simply have to be appointed by the mayor. So I wouldn't be in favor in this case. I do think it's a once-in-a-generation circumstance, and I think we just ought to address it in that way. A promise was made to him, and you know, we're in a position to help to do the first step in honoring that promise. But this idea of extending it to the Board of Supervisors, I don't know where that came from.
Okay, so I think there are two issues. One is whether the further restriction on the type, the position that the mayor could take upon leaving the position of mayor, and secondly, whether to extend it to the board. And I think we need to certainly talk about both of those, but I think it probably makes sense to talk about them one at a time. So let's start with the Commissioner Ward, your first point, which is it too restrictive? Are we comfortable with the restriction? What other comments or questions do commissioners have? Commissioner Sedley?
I strongly prefer the narrower version that's before us right now on this basis. I really look at it as remaining true to the restriction that the voters put in place. For me, that's what's controlling. And we are limited in what we can do through act of the Board of Supervisors and the Ethics Commission to provisions that further the purposes of the voter passed initiative. And I'm concerned that the original provision might not be consistent with the voters' purposes. I admit I don't have the rationale for the materials for the original budget, for the original ballot initiative that was put before us, in part because we saw the opportunity to consider a narrower provision. To me, we are trying to create circumstances in which anyone who takes the mayor's position, let's do it as you suggested, just the mayor's position, at the request of the Board of Supervisors, presumably interpreting what they understood to be in the best interest of the city, to not make someone who agrees to do that worse off than he or she would have been before agreeing to serve in that way. I think I personally would take notice, whether others would, that it's a substantial undertaking, a big headache, and if the city calls, we would like someone to be able to do that. But I think that we, at the same time, we have to look beyond the situation before us right now and think about the possible consequences if it were to arise again. We are being asked to make law in a direction different than the voters did. And I take that very seriously and try to think what would be consistent with the provisions that we've adopted. The narrower provision says you can go back to the job you had before, for which the individual was chosen without the advantage of being mayor, without the additional connections, the opportunity. Worst case scenario, in a completely generic, I don't say any individual here would do this, but the mayor has the ability to not only create jobs, but clear out jobs and then potentially move into them after a time as mayor. So that seems going too far to me. I am comfortable with the idea of returning to a position one sought, was hired for, and was performing in up until the moment of the point of selection. I think Commissioner Ward raises an interesting wrinkle, but as I think about it, in your question to Mr. True, but as I think about that question, that puts the person back in exactly the same position they would have been. Someone who serves at the pleasure of the mayor, always serves at the pleasure of the mayor, and is subject to the mayor saying, I would like to change the person who is in this position. So that person is not deprived of any protection by having served as mayor, return to their job, and a job that has the same conditions of appointment and employment that they had before. So I'd be comfortable with the replacement, but not with the original provision.
Respond to that?
Yes, Dr. Chair.
In the present circumstance, we're dealing with a situation where the mayor was reluctant to leave his position for the very reason that he thought that he might not be able to get his job back, probably because of this ordinance. And he was given assurances that things would be, that it would be made possible for him to return to city employment.
Well, this may be livelier than people want. I'll just have two things to say. One is I'm happy to support a provision that says that a person who is appointed to the mayor's job can return to the job he or she held before that appointment. I think that addresses the current circumstance. The Ethics Commission made no promise to anyone in this scenario, and I don't feel obligated by any hope, expectation, commitment. That doesn't mean I don't respect Mayor Lee's decision to do this on behalf of the city. I think it is something that was very important to the city, but that's completely different from what I think my obligation is as an ethics commissioner, or whether there is a promise, a hope, an expectation, a dream, or an idea out there. But I am prepared to vote for something that would happen, but not for the single purpose, that would happen to allow him to return to the highly responsible job that he was doing before asked by the city to be its mayor.
Commissioners, any other comments in response to Commissioner Ward and Commissioner Studley? Commissioner Hand?
I mean, the bottom line for me is that Mayor Ed Lee has rendered a great service to the city and county of San Francisco by agreeing to take this interim position as the mayor of the city. He has saved the city a lot of grief, a lot of money. I think that it's only right that we should not punish him for having rendered this service. And I do think that the narrower provision probably is the one that makes the most sense. It's simple, it's straightforward, and I think we should allow him to go back to his original position prior to taking on this temporary job. Beyond that, I don't know that it should go any further than that.
Commissioner Liu.
Thank you, Chair Herr. I agree that there are really a vast array of compelling factors in favor of this amendment, actually in favor of the broader amendment. But when I was listening to the arguments, and it was a question I had in coming to this meeting, when I was listening to the arguments for a more restrictive modification where the mayor would be going back to just his former position, I was really very much persuaded by that for all the policy reasons articulated by Commissioner Studley. And it's because we are setting forth a policy decision that, even though its genesis is Mayor Lee's situation, it would be on the books as a policy decision going forward. So I had that concern. And I just will be frank that Commissioner Ward raised a really good point about the unintended consequences of that restriction. And so I would welcome further thought from Commissioner Ward on that. But, it is an unintended consequence, and I would hate for Mayor Lee to be penalized because of that. And as Mr. True pointed out, this is it's unprecedented and unlikely to come up again. So I'd welcome any more comments on that.
I need to clarify something with the city attorney. There's a few city positions that are appointed for a specific period of time. City administrator is one of them, isn't it?
Right. It's a five-year term appointed by the mayor with confirmation by the board.
Right. So at the end, in November, Mayor Lee's term as city administrator will not have expired.
I believe the term actually, unlike the terms for, say, members of this commission or members of the board, the term actually, the 5 years begins upon appointment,
okay.
As opposed to running
right.
at certain dates.
Exactly. But I mean, is his five-year term, it has not lapsed.
Well, he resigned the position. Okay. In order to accept the office of
so
mayor.
That stopped so the would, clock on it.
He would begin a new five-year right. term if he were reappointed.
And right. he would have to be reappointed and reconfirmed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, a follow-up question to that. So at the time that he resigned, you know, he had the five-year so term. Position. The commitment was for until 2014 or something like that. But was he serving at the pleasure of the mayor, whoever would be elected in November?
I don't believe that position serves at the pleasure of the mayor. I believe it's subject to official misconduct, removal for official misconduct only, unlike many other city positions.
Well, I think Mr. St. Croix's question makes me ask whether he now has a position he can return to. He's not on leave from a position and serving as mayor. So does... I'm just looking again at the language and thinking out loud. Reappointment, so he could be reappointed to.
Right.
It's not reassume or
right.
return to, but yeah. reappointment to the city.
And
position.
When those five-year terms are up, whoever is in charge at the time can reappoint him. There's not a sunset on those.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Commissioner Ward, did you?
No, I just reiterate that my concern about the narrow version of this is the possibility that the elected mayor may not be willing to reappoint him to his former position, which would disqualify him then from any position in city government for a year. And that to me is a penalty.
I came into this meeting in favor of this narrower legislation. I will say, though, that the consequence that we've just discussed is troubling for this reason. It puts the mayor in a position to weigh his future employment versus his current role as mayor, and hopefully those would never conflict, but I could imagine a situation where Mayor Lee has some sense of who he thinks the next mayor is going to be, and that puts him in an awkward situation whereby he may be in a situation where he's trying to figure out what he's going to do next while also serving the people of San Francisco without any burdens about what his next job will be. So that is certainly a concern, especially in a situation where it was more clear who might be the next mayor. So maybe we consider the salary proposal made by Mr. True. I mean, that would provide a little more flexibility for the mayor to get a position with a similar reduced risk of creating for himself some type of golden parachute as contemplated by the ordinance in the first instance.
Can you explain what you mean by that? The positions that we're talking about in this scenario or the hypothetical that Mr. True used seem to be at the highest levels of city compensation. So what do you mean by the salary?
Meaning that he could not take a position that paid him more than he earned at the time that he left his previous
okay.
job.
I would just point out, I think city administrator is one of the top 10 highest paid officials in the city, so that's a limitation, but not a huge one.
Well, it might, I think you're thinking in this scenario about other circumstances, so that somebody who came from a lower paid position couldn't.
Right, and another person.
Leap up.
Right.
Another
intern. Unless. I have a question, I think it's for Mr. Givner, about whether there's any law on the subject or interpretation on whether an amendment furthers the purpose of an original initiative. I know that's likely to be a complicated one.
Yeah, this often comes up when you're when this commission is considering amending the ethics ordinances or the campaign finance reform ordinance, and and generally it's a policy judgment, and that the commission is in the best position to determine. If you'd like, we could. I can't do it off the top of my head, but we could give you more information about where this restriction came from. It was adopted by the voters in 2003, but I think it preceded that. A lot of the provisions that were adopted in 2003 are older. I doubt there will be much there in terms of information in the voter pamphlet on this particular provision, because a lot of these were omnibus ethics ordinances that were adopted in chunks by the voters.
Commissioner Liu?
So I would be in favor of the more, still the restricted modification, but with the more flexible salary caveat to it, just because I do think that if we talk about just, he's restricted to just the position he came from, it may have some unintended consequences, and he wouldn't really be in this, even if he went back to it, he wouldn't necessarily be in the same position as when he left in terms of where he was at the time he resigned. So I would be in favor still of a more restrictive amendment, so because I think that's more in keeping with the policy of the code along the lines of a salary restriction rather than a position restriction. And we'd have to see what the language might look like on that, I suppose.
I had a brief conversation shortly before this meeting with Mr. True, and anticipating that he was going to raise the issue, drafted something that I can circulate on that. So now you've got even more versions.
Thank you. I don't think we have enough versions yet.
So. Could be the federal budget. But not drive it to resolution, that's all I know. Sometimes you never know what they'll say.
This one's a bit more of a mouthful. I also have a version of this that would apply to the mayor and member of the board, but if you want that later.
It's on line 22 of page 3, is that it? Should we read it for the audience,
yes,
or do they have it?
Yeah. Mr. St. Croix, would you mind?
Notwithstanding the one-year restriction in subsection A, a former mayor who was appointed to that office under Charter Section 13.101.5 to fill a vacancy shall be eligible for appointment to any city employment, provided that, one, the former mayor did not file a declaration of candidacy for election to the office of mayor after being appointed to that office. Two, the former mayor was employed by the city immediately prior to assuming the office of mayor. And three, the salary in the first year of the new employment shall not exceed the salary received by the former mayor in the city employment that he or she held immediately prior to assuming office as mayor.
Mr. True.
Thank you, Chair Hur and Commissioners. Judson True again from President David Chu's office. I apologize if this complicates the already meaty discussion more, but I wanted to just clarify this for the record. When I raised this idea, with the Deputy City Attorney, I think the intention of it was more around if the commission decided to add in the supervisors. Because I think, as Mr. St. Croix pointed out, the city administrator's salary is rightfully on the higher level for the city structure, whereas the supervisors are in more of a middle range. And I thought that if the commission did, and I did talk to President Chu about this, if the commission did decide to put in the supervisors, which it doesn't sound like is a likelihood, then it might make sense not to restrict them to a particular position, but to a salary level for leverage reasons and to make sure they weren't going for a golden parachute. So I just wanted to lay that out, not to complicate your discussion further, but I did want to make that clarification that that idea arose more around consideration of the supervisors, but of course this matter is entirely in your hands.
Are you saying that it would not be effective for just the mayor?
It's not clear to me given the, I mean, I'm thinking about the potential interim mayors that were considered by the board for discussion. Most of them came from positions that were quite senior within the bureaucracy of the city and high salaried. It is, of course, possible that a supervisor or someone, although that's an entirely different situation because they couldn't return to the position, right? A supervisor could not return as a supervisor if they took the interim mayor job, for example. That would be not legal. But although they could be appointed potentially. Yeah, they could be appointed. Okay. Sorry for that, working that through in my head. So it was just around more just because supervisors are, I don't know exactly what it is, but close to 95,000, and whereas the other senior positions tend to be in the higher range. So that's all I wanted to just lay out. I don't mean to complicate any of the points of the commissioners further, but that's the point I wanted to make.
I find this helpful, at least worth thinking about. It would avoid the mischief that Commissioner Ward has pointed out. And for my part, I keep going to a future situation with players to be named, people that we don't know. And it would keep a future mayor in that circumstance from significantly bumping the salary of a job that he or she had either been in or had their eye on, and I think that that would be helpful for perception reasons, at the very least, in terms of how the public felt about that kind of transition. So while this one I think is likely to follow from, it'd be relatively straightforward, and I could argue for that narrowest reading on the basis that had someone other than Mayor Lee been chosen as mayor at this moment, that person would have the right to reappoint him or not reappointment at the end of the time of his five-year term. So it doesn't leave him any worse off. That is still the scenario that would be in play. But I think this one may create a little more leeway to avoid a rock in a hard place kind of situation without the open door that I thought the broader provision might offer.
Commissioner Ward, do you think that this addresses some of the concerns that you were previously expressing about the more limited restrictions?
Well, somewhat, but I mean, I understand Commissioner Studley's view toward the future and not making this a decision around Mayor Lee. I'm making the decision around Mayor Lee because of what we know. We know that he was reluctant to leave his position for fear that he would not be able to go back to his position. And so that's my thinking, and that's what I'm trying to address here. I don't think it's unreasonable to look forward, but again, it's a once-in-a-generation circumstance. This is not likely to happen again for a very long time. So I'm trying to do our part for, and it comes in parts, and I'm trying to do our part to honor what the city has said that they would do for Mayor Lee were he to take the position, which he did.
I think it's worth discussing the second point that Commissioner Ward had raised earlier, which is whether this should be extended to the Board of Supervisors. Do commissioners have any comments on that part of the proposal?
I think when I look at the policy reasons and the rationales, it's all the same policy reasons and rationales. I mean, the way the code is worded, it would makes sense to me to extend it. I do understand Commissioner Ward's point about why address a situation that hasn't come up. But if we're looking at amending, we're looking at an amendment. We're not. This isn't a situation where we're deciding to grant someone, you know, a quote unquote waiver or anything like that. I mean, this is actually amending the code and amending the regulation. So I think the same policy considerations and rationale should be extended to members of the Board of Supervisors simply because of the way it's written in the code, and it makes sense to me. But I would be in favor of the further restriction and modification that we've just been discussing extended to that proviso as well.
Well, I would need to hear some arguments as to why we should extend it to the Board of Supervisors. I don't, you know, there's no situation that has come up, to my knowledge, that is comparable to the one we're facing with the mayor. And until such a situation would arise, I don't know why we would pass or expand the legislation to the Board of Supervisors at this time.
The answer is very, very simple. The underlying ordinance applies only to the mayor and the board. So when this is sent over, since we're amending something that applies to two entities, we thought, well, why just do one? Why not do both? Because it's just the one ordinance. If the commissioners prefer, I mean, certainly don't need to include the board, and we can wait till such a time as any, if any, that a situation develops of a similar nature at the board and do it then. But we were just trying to be consistent within the ordinance itself. That's all. There was no motivation, no scenario we cooked up, or anything like that.
I'd actually be interested in hearing if there's public comment on this issue, because I can see it in a couple of different ways, and on this one I'd like to come back to it. So I think there isn't. We can do it now. You're right, we could do it if there were a forcing event, but there's a middle ground, which is we could do it after further. We could do the mayoral one because there are decision processes that relate to it, and then consider whether we want to do it, keep them parallel and do it for the board. So I'd be interested if there's any public comment on point.
I think we're going to take public comment after we discuss all the proposals, yes. But I agree that public comment will be informative in the discussion. On the issue of extending it to the board, I am sympathetic to Commissioner Ward's arguments at this point, and do wonder whether it's necessary to take such action in light of the very obvious issue we're trying to deal with, and that is the mayor's situation. Any other comments on the Board of Supervisors before we?
Just to address Commissioner Haynes' point, I think it had come up, but it didn't materialize to the point where we would be considering, where the commission would be considering it now. I think it had come up with Supervisor Ellsburn and Supervisor Chu, where they had been appointed, and it could have come up, and so perhaps, you know, it could arise in the future. But I completely understand with not wanting to extend it at this time before is necessary. But I do think for policy reasons, consistency with the ordinance, it makes sense. I don't really see policy reasons against it other than what you've articulated, that the situation isn't presently before us at this time.
Commissioner Ward, did you have?
I just think that if you're trying to replace a supervisor, which the mayor does, and you find someone in city government who is reluctant, you move on to the next person. That wasn't the case with the mayor. They couldn't get a majority of the board to agree on anyone other than Mayor Lee. In the Board of Supervisors had to agree. In the case of a supervisor being appointed, it's one person on a body of 10 or 11, and if you find someone who has the same reluctance that Mayor Lee has about leaving their position, because they wouldn't be able to go back to it, you just go on to the next person. That's exactly what would happen. So I don't see that it's – I don't see the compelling reason to include supervisors in this change, and I expect that the public is going to be awfully surprised to learn that, because we took up this matter that's been public for months around honoring this promise that was made to the mayor, that all of a sudden now it's been extended to the Board of Supervisors. I don't think that I'd be, as a member of the public, I'd be surprised myself.
Are there any comments or need for discussion on the board's proposal, on the broader proposal that, that it not that the mayor be permitted to go back to any city employment? Any comments from the commissioners on that proposal? Okay, I think we should take public comment.
Good evening, Thomas Piccarello. The voters aren't surprised. Probably the voters are angry. Let's understand this. This ordinance was enacted by the voters, not the Board of Supervisors and not the Ethics Commission. The ordinance provides that you must find that the amendment furthers the purpose of the chapter. There is special legislation for one individual does not further the purposes of the chapter. The Board of Supervisors made illegal promises to Mr. Lee, and now you're asked to ratify the illegal promises given to Mr. Lee by the Board of Supervisors. That makes no sense. Makes no sense at all. I'm also troubled by the litmus test that was given to the candidate of the Board of Supervisors seat before he or she was appointed. That's also troubling. And finally, let me say this. If you pass legislation that just favors one person, you're going to have a legal challenge. Thank you.
Good evening. Good evening, Commissioner Herr. I haven't seen you since the David Chu campaign. Good evening,
nice
other
to see
commissioners.
You again.
I'm John Gollinger. I am a member of the public and the spokesperson for San Franciscans for Clean Government, and can say absolutely, certainly been following this issue closely since January, and was quite surprised over the weekend to learn of the proposal to do what we would characterize as dramatically expand this exemption. I mean, you know, what was certainly considered a simple, you know, once in a generation, once in the last 30 years, this is the first time we've had an interim mayor. In the last 30 years, we've had 14 appointed members of the Board of Supervisors, so one almost every other year. It's been a couple years, but this is something, and as you all well know, there are two members of the current board who are on the ballot this fall, so it's quite likely that one, if not both, vacancies will be appointed by the next mayor. So that taking this into the realm of supervisors creates an entirely new piece of legislation. And if nothing else, that deserves far greater consideration, raises far greater number of issues in terms of the golden parachute possibilities. There's a rumored candidate for District 5 supervisor who heads a current city department, that if that person or anyone similar were appointed to fill a vacancy, they wouldn't have to actually decide until August of next year whether they were going to run for office. So until then, they could still make policy decisions affecting the budget in their department, their own salary, until August, at which time they could choose whether to run or not. So we would urge the commission to keep this targeted to the mayor. I would also add information I learned from a memo written by Deputy Executive Director Eng back in 2005 to Tony Hall, that this provision actually has a long history. It's been in the San Francisco City Charter since at least 1932 and was put in place to deal with a public corruption problem at the time, was targeted to the mayor and the board, has stuck intact without a single change in every charter revision, every ethics commission change in the last 80 or so years, And for this to go from being a very targeted situation to a broad sweeping change would be a shame to do. And if nothing else, that should go before the voters. I would add one more thing as to the original proposal. Rather than tweak it to try to affect the salary or the job position of some unknown future appointed mayor a year from now or 30 years from now, why not put a sunset date in the ordinance that you're considering regarding Mayor Ed Lee? Why not put a sunset date July 1st of next year, the end of next year, February 1st, whatever date you choose? But that's a way to not, you know, there still could be an argument it's designed around a particular person, but as Commissioner Ward said, it's hard to really pretend that it's not. But if you put a sunset date, as is done all the time in legislation, that would be something that wouldn't put the person's name in there and would still be a policy decision that the board could make and would have the intended effect. Might make your lives easier as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other public comment? Commissioners, I think on this particular issue, it may be worth some more discussion if you have other comments based on what we just heard from the public. I will say that I think in response to the first comment, much of the discussion about these alternative proposals is for the very reason that we are focused and concerned about making sure to be consistent with the will of the voters on this and to make an amendment that is consistent with that provision. I think with respect to the sunset, and secondly, with respect to whether this is just about Mayor Lee, I mean, I think certainly this the public's interest, the fact that this has come up does relate to him, but we are trying to create, if we're going to amend legislation, I think it does make sense for us to do the best we can to make it applicable for the future. And if it needs amendment down the road, that's one thing, but I think it would be short-sighted of us to make it just for this one, with only this instance in mind.
Speaking to that second point about the sunset date, I found that an interesting idea, but if we did that, we, because sometimes once in a generation things do kind of clump up and it happens again sooner than you expected. A very similar scenario would have left a person considering taking the role that of mayor in exactly the same position of uncertainty that City Administrator Lee faced at the time that he did it. He had to take a leap, hoping that it would be possible to make these adjustments that we're considering now. So while I like the idea of not opening a door and staying as narrow and true to the purpose as possible, having confronted the issue and seen that it could happen, it might be helpful to the board and a candidate for such office if this remained in place. Now, if that did happen, somebody might be able to say, I'm strengthened by the precedent and I saw what happened, and they would know more than City Administrator Lee knew at the time, because this had never been done to solve to address the situation. So I think that one's a close call that has both the concerns that you described but the attraction that the speaker offered as well.
Commissioner Hahn?
I too was intrigued by the idea of a sunset date. However, although this appears to be a unique situation, none of us has a crystal ball, so we do not know what will happen tomorrow, and we don't know what will happen a year from now or 10 years from now. So therefore, I do think that the necessity of a sunset date, I don't think that we need that in this legislation with regards to the mayor's position. If we're going to discuss the Board of Supervisors, I think that the numbers that were mentioned by one of the members of the audience, I think, is a compelling argument as to why the Board of Supervisors should not be part of this legislation. You have that. We don't need a crystal ball to know that there are going to be many, many interim appointments on the Board of Supervisors, as there has been in the past. And there, I think, the possibility of questionable, you know, behavior or appointments, and the churning of people going in and out of city bureaucracy into appointed positions, I think, is much more troubling. And therefore, I really don't think that it should apply to the Board of Supervisors. But we can deal with this one unique situation, which, you know, we can leave on the books for the future should something arise again. So that's kind of how I'm seeing it. I don't see the need to take it to apply it to the Board of Supervisors at this time.
After listening to all the comments, I would agree that we should probably table that issue of extending it to the Board of Supervisors for now, since there's no compelling reason to do it now, and we can address the policy arguments when it arises.
Is there a motion?
Would you like to make the motion?
Go right ahead.
I would move that we approve the narrower provision. I don't have the language, but Mr. St. Croix did.
That the one with the salary?
That would allow an appointed mayor to return to his or her position, or one in which the salary in the first year does not exceed the salary received by the former mayor,
right,
immediately prior to assuming office, and without reference to the Board of Supervisors.
Should I read the language one more time?
Sure.
B, notwithstanding the one-year restriction in subsection A.
What? Can I jump in? Because I drafted this language at 5:15, and as you were talking, I realized there's something in there that
okay.
may be a problem. So I think I can fix it. The way it's drafted, this would prohibit, would restrict the salary to the so that the new salary could not exceed the salary received by the person in the former job. And I'm no expert in how all the city salaries work, but they may be adjusted. The city administrator salary may be different a year from now than it was a year prior.
The person might have taken a leave without pay during the previous cycle and therefore received less than it was posted for.
True, right. So I was going to suggest that it be changed to the salary in the first year of the new employment shall not exceed the salary for the position the former mayor held immediately prior to assuming the office of mayor. That makes sense.
I don't really like that because it doesn't address the concern that Commissioner Studley originally raised, which is, well, the mayor could change that salary or that salary, right? And so I think limiting it to what the mayor received, and with an interim mayor, we're talking about 18 months at most that they'll be in that position. So I think sending them back to the salary they made 18 months prior is not a penalty so restrictive that it would not encourage them to take the post in the first place. But I'd welcome any comments from the commission on that.
Well, can we just leave the salary portion out of it? Is that
no.
as troublesome as some right. have said?
I don't think so.
I think the salary provision was to allow the person to move laterally to another city position. No.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. No,
so does your...
I think the way it's drafted
Givner's
is what we want.
Let's look at Mr. Givner's language of whether it does that. The former...
I'm sorry?
What,
the way that it is currently drafted
yes.
is what you want to do.
Right. Shall be eligible for appointment to any city employment as long as they were employed by the city before and the salary is no higher than what they previously received. Without that, you wouldn't have the ability to move to another role if, for example, it was an appointed position or the term had run during the time the person was away, or the job were disappeared for no fault of their own.
Let me try to read this again. Notwithstanding the one-year restriction in subsection A, a former mayor who was appointed to that office under Charter Section 13.101.5 to fill a vacancy shall be eligible for appointment to any city employment, provided that, one, the former mayor did not file a declaration of candidacy for election to the office of mayor after being appointed to that office, two, the former mayor was employed by the city immediately prior to assuming the office of mayor, and three, the salary in the first year of the new employment shall not exceed the salary received by the former mayor in the city employment that he or she held immediately prior to assuming office as mayor.
So moved without the Board of Supervisors element of this draft.
I second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The next item on the agenda is consideration of a letter to Dr. Judy Melanek. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this agenda item?
Actually, I think Mabel's going to do that.
Okay, Mabel. Ms. Ng?
Sure. This is a draft advice letter to Dr. Melanek, who is in the audience today, and I know that she would like to speak as well. But what she had asked the commission to do was to provide an advice letter on several issues. One was she wanted to kind of appeal the advance written determination that was provided to her by the chief medical examiner and also the city administrator regarding a specific provision in the statement of incompatible activities of the General Services Administration. So the staff has drafted advice regarding that specific aspect of it. Staff has also drafted language in the letter that deals with a couple of other allegations or other concerns that she raised. And one of them is that her concern is that the GSA's SIA is not valid because meet and confer with the unions did not occur. And her second concern is that the commission take action to amend the SIA. I think the letter somewhat clearly sets forth staff's reasoning behind this, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. And I do know that Dr. Melanek is here, so.
Thank you, Ms. Dr. Melanek, would you like to speak before we?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Herr. I have my statement. I actually made copies, if you want. I'm responding to the draft letter that was posted at the website that was written by staff. Dear Commissioners, your draft letter, dated April 2010, contains factual errors, does not address all the issues raised by my letter of February 24th, and is insufficient to resolve this problem. The most egregious factual error is on page 5, where it states, quote, in drafting the SIAs, the Commission worked closely with the management and employees of each department. The employees of our department were not consulted in drafting the SIA. It was written entirely by the chief medical examiner. Where it says, quote, the commission recognized that department heads generally are well equipped to determine whether specific outside activities are incompatible, inconsistent, or in conflict with the mission of their departments. It assumes that the decision made by the department head is legal and in the best interests of the city. The AWD process, as it is being implemented, is neither. The matrix at the end of the draft response is completely insufficient. It does not address why assistant medical examiners and other employees are being told by their supervisor that they will have to disregard subpoenas from other California counties when they have offered their services on their vacation time in order to help adjacent counties deal with a nationwide shortage of board-certified forensic pathologists, toxicologists, and death investigators. No employee should have to choose between breaking the law and losing his job. The matrix still relies on the illegal and unworkable AWD process, that's advanced written determination, that does not clearly define relationships, conflict of interest, or adverse consequences to the county, terms that are the basis for a denial. It's the AWD process that requires a review of the content of our testimonial speech, with our supervisor requesting we disclose confidential details about the parties in the lawsuit and the scope of our professional opinions. Finally, and most importantly, your draft letter does not address ethics. It is wrong for the city and county of San Francisco to restrict testimony to cover up negligence in another county or by one of its vendors. This is an infringement on free speech under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, and it's also bad government. This SIA doesn't just apply to paid testimony. As written, it applies to pro bono testimony and criminal defense testimony. I have consulted with assistant and chief medical examiners throughout the United States through my contacts at the National Association of Medical Examiners. Most offices allow private practice as long as it is not in the same county. That was the model in effect here under Dr. Boyd Stevens, the previous chief medical examiner, who owned a laboratory, had a private consult practice, and enjoyed a nationwide reputation. Some offices have in-house private practice consulting, which increases county revenue and decreases expenditures by supplementing officers' salaries. Dr. Smith and I, on several occasions, have suggested this model to Dr. Hart to increase revenue for the city and county, but we were told that it was, quote, not within the mission of the OCME. Finally, those rare offices that completely bar outside work do so as part of the terms of employment. When the terms of employment change, experienced employees leave and competent physicians will not take the vacant positions. In order for you to understand why this is so problematic for the professionals at our office, you need to know something about the practice of medicine. We incur a tremendous amount of debt in order to study medicine and maintain our licensure. Our professional reputations as physicians and pathologists are based in some degree on this expensive education, but it is also based on our professional publications and how many other pathologists and attorneys throughout the United States come to us for consultations. In the hospital setting, when a pathologist leaves, she takes her private practice with her. People consult her because of who she is and not because of what hospital she works for. Same thing applies in forensics. I have a national reputation as an expert in forensic pathology, not because I work for the city and county of San Francisco, but because I'm sought after to review and testify in high-profile cases throughout the country. I have earned this reputation because I testify honestly, competently, and ethically, and I have never failed to qualify as an expert. No one is saying that the city and county can't place restrictions on private practice consult work. We will honor restrictions that are fair and legal. We propose the SIA should be revised to state the following, quote, no officer or employee of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner may engage in testimony as a retained expert consultant in a case where the death occurred under the jurisdiction of the City and County of San Francisco or where the City and County of San Francisco is a named party in the lawsuit. That was the past practice, and that would be acceptable to the employees and, I believe, the unions. Most importantly, it would remove the illegal AWD process that relies too much on the judgment of the chief medical examiner. If you, the Ethics Commission, or the city administrator doesn't revise the SIA, since my union has already filed grievance and achieved an impasse, I will be forced to pursue other legal avenues. And the office of the chief medical examiner, unfortunately, will experience a completely preventable loss of its experienced technical personnel as they seek employment elsewhere in adjacent counties that do not restrict the practice of medicine in this patently unethical and illegal manner. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions for Dr. Melnick?
I have one question. Dr. Melnick, you had indicated that you previously have been granted permission to testify in cases unrelated to your job. Did those situations involve public agencies or public entities?
Yes. In the past, they have.
Okay.
And I should add, on both plaintiffs and defense. So I've testified for public agencies in defense as advising defense counsel as well as advising plaintiff's counsel.
Okay. Did they involve San Mateo County as well?
There was one case involving San Mateo County where that had been granted in the past.
Commissioner Hand.
I have a question about the change in practice. You stated that this was passed, the ability to testify or be a consultant was past practice under Boyd Stevens. Could you elaborate on why that changed and the philosophy or the thinking in that change when that took place?
I can only speak to what I've been told. I can't speak for the chief medical examiner. Dr. Boyd Stevens did consult work. He did it on his own time. He had a private practice laboratory, and he also had a private practice consulting. Some of the consulting he did, I believe, increased revenue for the city and county, but I've spoken subsequently to attorneys who have consulted him in a private capacity, so I know he did both. I believe that the policy, when I was hired, Dr. Stevens was still at the office in a consultant capacity, and the chief medical examiner was Dr. Hart, and I was told when I was hired that consult work was allowed as long as it wasn't against the city and county of San Francisco, and it wasn't within our jurisdiction. So I had continued my work. I had this private practice before. And it included some high-profile cases, including in-custody deaths and medical malpractice issues. And some of those cases defended counties, and some of them were plaintiffs against county, including Sacramento County, including a county in Oregon, in Portland. So that was both sides. And some of the attorneys who have written statements of support work either on plaintiffs or defense. So I can't speak to why the chief medical examiner changed the policy. The SIA, like I said, it was written by the chief without consultations. My initial information from the union was that a meet and confer did not occur. They filed a grievance based on that, and it reached an impasse. And that's all I can answer to your question.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I just wanted a clarification. So you're saying when you did testify for and or against public entities, that was prior to this SIA being adopted in 2007?
No, it was after the SIA was adopted, actually, but it was prior to it being actively implemented by our department. So it was not initially implemented right away. We weren't asked to fill out the AWDs, I think, until 2009.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Melinek, were you aware of the development of an SIA standard, of these standards for the department before they were put into place?
I don't know what you mean, was I aware of the development. I remember when the SIA first came out, and I went to my union representatives, and I said, this looks problematic. And we that was back in 2007 or whenever. I don't remember when it was first given to us. I'd have to look through my files. But I remember seeing it and being told that the advanced written determination was not a form. It was just the every six-month approval that we go through automatically for doing outside work. So we already have a form every 6 months that we fill out when we do outside work to show that we're not doing too many hours, anything like that. And that every six-month approval we had been doing since I was hired. So when I first saw the SIA, whenever it was, and I honestly don't remember the date, I was being informed by my union and my union representatives that, oh, it's just the same form that you've always been doing. And then sometime in, I think, late 2009, maybe early 2010, we were told that we have to fill out this advanced written determination form where all of a sudden I have to write the details of the case, sometimes the details of my opinion, and I'm being essentially cross-examined about what the case involves and what my opinions are by the chief medical examiner in order for her to render a decision. And that was when I started getting concerned about issues of attorney-client privilege and confidentiality, some of the more criminal cases. And then up until this case, Wolkoff v. AMR, all of the permissions had been granted, including cases both for and against public entity, including San Mateo.
My question was just a little bit different. If you could go back a step.
Sure.
Were you aware that a statement of incompatible activities was in development in your department?
I don't know
before you were told that it was put into effect.
No, I was not aware that it was in development. I saw it after it was already put in effect for the first time.
Any other questions for Dr. Melinek at this time?
I have one more procedural question, Dr. Melnick. So what's the status of the case now? Is it over?
I've ever since the determination that I couldn't work on it, I had written an opinion, but I hadn't testified. So I can't say what the status of the case is, but the attorney who represents plaintiff in this case is here. And I believe he wants to speak for public comment. Or you can ask him if you'd like.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, before we begin our discussion, I have a procedural question. It appears from the memo that we cannot actually, here today, amend the SIA process that Dr. Melnick is complaining of here. Is that correct?
That is correct. That's based on staff's recommendation that an amendment is not necessary, based on our conversations with representatives of the city administrator's office. If the commission wished to amend the SIA, we have to provide notice to the unions, and all the many other things have to be satisfied. So if you wanted to do it at a future date, we can certainly do it.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up question to that?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Does an amendment have to be initiated by the department?
No. It could be initiated by the Ethics Commission.
Okay, thank you.
In that same vein, am I correct, though, that we could ask the department to take a look at its current SIA or address particular questions if we did not want ab initio to take action on it ourselves without that kind of input?
You can certainly request that the department take a look at the SIA and see whether or not it wished to make some amendments or recommend some amendments. But the process is that no amendment would be effective unless the Ethics Commission approves it initially. We go through a meet and confer, and then the commission approves it finally. Although all of that can be done at one meeting.
Remember it well.
Yes.
My next procedural question is with respect to the formal written advice letter. I presume that regardless of what the commission ultimately determines, that does not change or cannot change the decision that was made in response to the AWD.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Commissioners, any comments or discussion?
Not at this time.
Not at this time, no.
I think, Dr. Melnick, from my point of view, I certainly cannot impugn any of the testimony you've given in the past. I am an attorney who works with experts frequently, and the letters that you receive from the lawyers you work for and the additional things you submitted suggest that you are an excellent testifier and that you have done a great service for the people that for whom you have on whose behalf you have testified. My biggest problem here is that I don't think that we can do what you're asking us to do. And I think Commissioner Studley's question about, you know, perhaps we can ask the department to think again about their SIA process and to propose modifications if appropriate, and have the staff have that discussion with them. It's probably the most we can do at this point because it's kind of out of our hands, it appears. Public comment?
Good evening. My name is Stephen Brewer. I am the attorney who retained the services of Dr. Melnick in a case called Wolkoff versus American Medical Response, County of San Mateo, and several other entities. The case arose out of a tragic automobile accident when my client's son was killed on Highway 1 in southern San Mateo County and became, unfortunately, a coroner's case in the county of San Mateo. On May 13th, 2010, I took the deposition of the county coroner of San Mateo, Robert Fulcrault, as well as the chief medical examiner under him, Dr. Peter Benson, in order to determine the facts of Stephen Wolkoff's death. At the time of the deposition, it became very clear that neither Mr. Fulcrault nor Dr. Benson were going to be very forthcoming about what actually caused Stephen Wolkoff's death on June 21st, 2008. As a result, I called Dr. Melnick on May 18th, 2010, and retained her services in order to evaluate the autopsy that had been done, as well as to review the tissue samples that were retained from Stephen Wolkoff in order to determine his actual cause of death. That case is still pending. To answer your question, Commissioner, the matter is a very sensitive one, obviously, for my clients. The information that Dr. Melnick has, and I hope will be able to provide, is an essential element of the case that I have on behalf of the Wolkoff family. One of the areas I saw in the proposed letter from the staff was that there are six questions that need to be answered in order to determine whether or not Dr. Melnick or someone in her capacity could testify in a given case. And in particular, I point the commission to question number six, which unfortunately is the last question of the series, which frankly should be the first question that's asked. And that question is, has any party already relied on your ability to testify in the case based on an agreement you entered into prior to June 2010 to provide such testimony? If the answer to that question is yes, the outside activity is not incompatible and the department head will grant the AWD. This particular case, the agreement with Dr. Melnick was entered into prior to June 2010. It was entered into on or about May 18th, 2010. Now, I appreciate that that's a short period of time, but in strict compliance with the SIA, I do not believe that the department head's AWD determination, which was subsequently upheld on behalf of the city manager, is appropriate, legal, or should be binding in this case. And in that extent, I believe and I would hope that this commission would have the power and authority to direct the head of the department or whoever else has the ability to re-examine, re-evaluate, and look at this AWD to do so and do it correctly so that my clients will ultimately be able to bring forth the necessary evidence that is required in order to sustain their burden of proof in the civil case, and also so that the truth of this matter will not get swept under the rug by a code of silence that apparently is developing in the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office by protecting other public entities and other public agencies from truthful and fair testimony by its employees in those cases. Thank you.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Adam Zapala. I'm an attorney at Davis Cowell and Bow. We are attorneys for UAPD. That's the Union of American Physicians and Dentists, one of the bargaining representatives for Judy. I've come today to just express some of our grave concerns about the policy and the broad policy itself, but also the particular decision in this case. I know I have a brief amount of time to speak, so I want to keep it short. And focus just really on one point, and that is stated simply the policy violates the First Amendment. Now, I know that this is not a commission that adjudicates First Amendment rights, but I do think you should be concerned as the Ethics Commission in San Francisco that the city and county is playing it fast and loose with the First Amendment. I would really encourage all of you to read the Hoover v. Morales case. This is a case out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's out of Texas. It's a very conservative court. And under circumstances that are very, very similar to this case, Texas implemented a policy trying to stop its university professors from testifying against the state. And the Fifth Circuit in that case was having none of it, said that the First Amendment protects public employees speaking on their own time, that this amorphous conflict of interest that nobody could really define, and in fact, in this case, nobody can really define either, and said that's just not weighty enough to overcome the important First Amendment rights that are at stake in this case. And there's an important case that just came out of the Ninth Circuit called Claremont v. Sound Mental Health relies to a good extent on Hoover v. Morales. And I think it's very clear that you cannot limit truthful testimony under some sort of poorly defined conflict of interest a law. I think also the reality is if we just step back for a moment and take a look at what's really going on here, these doctors have been informed that applications, when they want to testify for counties, that's not going to be a problem. The problem is when you're going and testifying against other counties. And I know there are lawyers on this committee. You'll know that that's just classic viewpoint discrimination. That's what it is. It's okay to testify on behalf of other counties, not okay to do it when you're testifying against other counties. It's viewpoint discrimination. It's subject to the strictest scrutiny that a court will look at a policy like this. It's going to be struck down. The last thing that I would sort of maybe touch on here is just, as you know, different types of speech are entitled to greater or lesser amounts of protection, a sort of a continuum of protection that courts give speech. Of course, the greatest protection that speech gets is political speech, and maybe on the lowest end would be commercial speech. This is not commercial speech. This is considered speech on a matter of public concern, and it's truthful testimony in a court of law. I really can't imagine any type of speech being entitled to greater protection than truthful testimony in a court of law. And then lastly, I would just say that the problem with the policy, and this is where I think maybe you do come in, like I said, I know you don't adjudicate First Amendment rights, but the policy just is so poorly defined that it gives too much discretion to decision makers, in this case Dr. Hart, to make decisions for personal reasons, for relationships that they have or don't have with employees in the office. So I think quite apart what happens in this particular case.
Sir, you've exceeded your time. Wrap it up.
Thank you. And I would just say that I think that militates in favor of making the policy more detailed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Comments from the commission?
I have another procedural question. I don't know if it's for the deputy city attorney or for Ms. Ng. So does the commission have authority to direct the department to reexamine an AWD or no?
I believe the answer to that question is no.
Okay.
Seems to me that I agree with the chair that we do not have authority to either grant or review an AWD, and I would hesitate to revise an SIA without, on the fly under these circumstances. But I would offer up for the other commissioners' consideration the possibility of asking the department to review the SIA with a set of questions from us suggesting our concerns. I think there is a point about both the policy and what lawyers will recognize as an as-applied standard, and ask them to come back to us because I think there are several different issues ranging from whether the power of question six and the meaning of that date and whether that should be a controlling exemption, and whether the policy itself is a wise one and how it is being applied. A policy can be acceptable but be applied in ways that are not satisfactory. So I feel that we are limited in what we can do here, but that we can very clearly ask for follow-up and further attention to this.
Commissioner Hand.
A question. Do we have the authority to ask department heads to appear before the Ethics Commission and discuss their SIAs and other documents? Just on an informational basis? But we can't make them appear if they don't wish to.
When we originally reviewed the SIAs, there was a department or agency representative who came to present each one, or came if they wanted to present each one. And they did so if they thought it was controversial or if there were questions, and in many cases, even if it was straightforward. So I don't know if your question about whether we can compel is a good one, but that was the practice.
Since I'm fairly new to this, I'm not familiar with what the process is for creating these policies, you know, the AWD or the SIA. Is it purely an intra-departmental process that takes place?
I don't know where to begin. The process was a very long process. The SIAs were actually called for under Prop E that was adopted by the voters in November 2003. In August of 2004, practically all of the city's boards, commissions, and departments submitted an SIA, a draft SIA, to the Ethics Commission for consideration. They then went over to the Civil Service Commission, which held hearings over a year's time. It was recommended that we adopt a template, so we did. We worked with the unions in adopting the template. We also worked with the departments in adopting a template. The commission adopted a template, and then we reworked all of the originally submitted SIAs to fit that template. And from then, the Ethics Commission began its initial consideration of the SIAs. We received testimony from department representatives, some union members, senior union representatives, and the commission initially approved each of the SIAs. After that, each of the SIAs was subject to meet and confer with the unions. We held several meetings over a course of time, and then the commission also finally approved the SIAs. The last time that the commission finally approved all the SIAs was in September of 2008. All the SIAs became effective 30 days later in October of 2008. So the process is a fairly long and involved process and involves many, many departments, not just the Ethics Commission. We kind of like just coordinated the whole thing and make sure that to the extent possible, all the SIAs follow a template so that any employee moving from one city department to another would be somewhat familiar with the SIAs. Now, the SIAs, if you violate the SIAs, it's deemed a violation of the conflict of interest law, so you would be subject to the same kinds of penalties as if you did violate an ethics law.
And in your discussion of this, you referred to the commission. You're referring to the Ethics Commission granting final approval?
Yes. The Ethics Commission as a whole granting final approval, and Commissioner Studley was here, as was Commissioner Ward, and I think they stayed awake for the entire time. Right?
And if we have the power to approve these SIAs, do we not have the authority to question them or review them at some point?
Yes.
So it sounds like what we could do is have the commission staff consult with the department, and as Commissioner Studley suggested, suggest our concerns and let them know that we would like their input because we're considering potentially revising the SIA for OME. OCME.
Yeah, I think that would be fine. I'd be happy to talk with the department representatives.
That's a clarification on the process you just described, Ms. Ng. So at what point or how many times were the unions notified? At what steps in the process were the unions notified?
I'm not going to address the template issue because that really was that involves all the departments. With respect to the SIA for each individual department, when before the Ethics Commission considered initially the SIA for initial approval, we sent emails to all of the unions that represent the affected employees. So they were notified at that point. When the after the initial approval, they went to a meet and confer with the unions, and the Department of Human Resources was in charge of that. And the Department of Human Resources, I think 30 days before any meeting, sent emails to the emails as well as facsimiles to the unions that represented the employees to let them know that there was a meet and confer. And also, I believe that those messages said that if you cannot attend, please let us know if you want to attend another day. Otherwise, you would have waived your right to a meet and confer. And then when the SIA was scheduled for final consideration by the Ethics Commission, we again notified all the unions that were affected. So they received notification at least on those three occasions.
And then going forward, if we ask the department to re-examine the SIAs, at what point would we need to notify the unions, or what would the meet and confer process be at that point?
If we are going to propose any changes to the SIA, we would need to notify the unions before the Ethics Commission meets. So we have to let them know of your meeting so that they can have public input. And then afterwards, if you initially approve the change, we have to engage in a meet and confer with them, and that's usually going to be handled by DHR. And then, so they will receive notification by DHR. And then afterwards, if the commission is ready to consider the amendments finally, we also have to provide a notification to the unions that you are going to be doing that.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Do we need a motion to have the staff talk to the department and convey those concerns? I just have one last substantive question about the memo. Was this assertion that Dr. Melnick was retained prior to June 2010 ever brought to the staff's attention?
No.
Okay. And then do we need a motion on the letter?
Yes, you need a motion on item one of the letter.
Is there such a motion?
The exception to the AWD.
What?
The exception to the AWD. This is on page 3. This is really the only aspect of the letter that is formal advice. The other is not formal advice. And let me just add, once you make a determination on this, if you decide to approve Section A, what we will do is forward this letter to the district attorney and the city attorney, and they would have to either concur or dissent, and then after that, we will issue the letter. That's the process.
So the only portion of the formal written advice would be the two paragraphs under B1?
Correct.
I think it'd probably be advisable to also approve the intro, the background section, leading up to B1. You could, of course, give your stamp of approval to the entire letter. That's a judgment for you. But the one thing that you must consider, or that the staff is technically.
And that's because Dr. Melnick has requested formal written advice.
Right.
Dr. Melnick, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Is that something you still want? I mean, in light of what you've heard from us, of what we can do, do you still want this formal written advice with respect to paragraphs in B1?
I'm sorry, I don't understand which paragraphs you were discussing. This is
in the memo.
In the draft?
The draft memo.
The April blank letter, page 3.
Page 3.
So page 3.
I mean, you've heard what we've
directed the staff to do with respect to talking to your department.
So will there be another letter? That's why I'm confused. Will there be another letter or direction issued to my department to look at the SIA? That's what I understood you were discussing.
I don't understand it to be a letter. I understand it to be a informal communication with the department, letting them know that the Ethics Commission is considering making revisions and that we would like their input.
Okay.
And that's something we can provide that's something we can do that's different from a formal written advice letter.
That would be fine, I think. I mean, that's okay. Can I just confer with the attorney?
I want to clarify something. That if you ratify what's in here, the entire letter is going to go as it's written. Okay, I want to make sure everybody understands.
What do you mean?
We're ratifying only up to a certain point. Then right. You're writing.
The letter says this part is formal written advice. The rest is informal. We don't need the commission's approval to send an informal advice. But the letter will. If you adopt that, the letter will go intact as it is.
But Dr. Melnick could withdraw it if she chose.
Yes.
So
she could withdraw
it. That's what I would want to do. I would want to withdraw it, and I would like you to do what you recommended, which is have the department look at the SIA again. Thank you very much.
Sure. Is there anything formal we have to do for that withdrawal, or is that sufficient?
No.
Having made the suggestion about asking the department to look at it, I would... rather than specify a timetable, I'll leave this to the staff, but I would encourage you to actually make clear that we are going to, if the other commissioners agree, that does not drift on their part, that we make clear either at what meeting we will do it or when we would like to hear back from them, or in some regard indicate our intent to return to it, preferably with their advice and participation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next item, did we? Next item?
Yeah.
Next item on the agenda is the staff presentation of the public finance report.
And he didn't make any eye contact with me until just now when he was leaving.
All right. The written report is before you. Very briefly, in the November 2010 election, 22 candidates qualified for public financing, and the candidates received a total of almost $1.5 million in public funds. The rest of the details are in the report. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to address them.
Commissioners, any questions?
I have a comment, not a question. I don't have questions because the report was so remarkably clear, thorough, anticipated my questions. I want to thank you, Ms. Scheich, and your staff. This was, and everyone who worked on this, it was very helpful, and you made something very complicated, very clear, and I appreciate the work that went into this. And into managing the entire much expanded process this year. So thank you very much.
I second that. Any other
good job.
Public comment on this issue? Hearing none. Do we need to? The next item on the agenda is a closed session. So we need a motion to go into closed session?
Yeah.
And then can I ask that we also take a break afterwards so that we can exchange city attorneys?
Yes.
Perhaps a restroom break
yes.
might be.
Yes, maybe a restroom break for everyone would be
thank you.
Needed. So should we move into private? I think we should move into, is there a motion to move into closed session?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
So we take public comment on that?
Yes.
Yes, we'll take public
comment. Public comment on whether we, any public comment on whether we should move into closed session. Okay. Hearing none.
Sorry.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. It's hard work to get into closed session.
The closed, right, it is hard to think about that.
We're back on the open record. Is there a motion?
Yes, I move that the commission find that it is in the best interest of the public not to disclose the deliberations we held in closed session regarding anticipated litigation. I think that's the one.
Is there a second?
Second.
Public comment? No public comment. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Agenda item number 8, minutes of the commission's regular meeting. Are there any proposed amendments? Seeing none, motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Public comment? No public comment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Number 9, executive director's reports.
No highlights tonight.
That's why you sat next to Charles, right?
This is how it used to be in the old days. We never got out of here before 11.
Do we do any? Is there no motion with respect to that, right?
Items. There's no public, so there's no public comment.
Nope. Any public comment? No public comment. Items for future meetings?
Not bloody likely.
public comment. Public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda that are within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission. Seeing none. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Public comment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.